You are listening to the Corrections Connection News Network, CCNN, your weekly news source for the corrections and criminal justice industry.
Welcome to today's live talk. I'm your host, Michelle Gasso. Today we will be speaking with Chase Rivlin, a corrections consultant and former secretary of the Department of Corrections in Washington State, about the use of protective custody in corrections and the challenges that can arise related to its use. Chase Rivlin is a principal of Rivlin Associates and has been a corrections professional since 1964, having served as the deputy administrator of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, executive director of the Colorado Department of Corrections, and from 1986 to 1997 as the Secretary of Washington State Department of Corrections. During his career, he also served as a regional administrator, institution superintendent, probation and parole supervisor, institution counselor, and probation and parole officer. Other experience includes administrative work in a Wisconsin mental health institute, faculty member of the University of Wisconsin, where he consulted with numerous state corrections and probation departments, and he's had many appearances and presentations for national professional organizations. Right now, he is serving as an expert witness on correctional issues. He's been involved in the Corrections Executive Excellence Program for the National Institute of Corrections. He has authored corrections publications, also served as an advisor and a board member to national organizations, and he's received numerous awards, so well qualified to talk about pretty much everything. Welcome to today's live talk, Mr. Rivlin.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you this morning?
We're very good. Well, we're very happy that you could join us from the West Coast today. As I said earlier, I wanted to talk with you about protective custody, and I want to start maybe with what is the need for protective custody in corrections, and how important is it for an agency to have in place policies and procedures to protect certain inmates?
Well, I think the need, both as a professional need, a moral need, arguably, and certainly a legal need. I think the courts have made it clear that corrections has a responsibility to protect those in its custody. Because frequently they don't have the freedom to protect themselves. And certainly, I think probably even superseding that is our professional responsibility to assure that it happens. And then I think there's simply a human moral responsibility that once an individual is placed in your custody, you have been handed the responsibility to protect them. I think the policies and procedures part of your question is it's the manner in which the given jurisdiction or agency articulates how it is that they assume that individuals in their custody will be protected, and it's simply laying out the roadmap so that everybody in the system understands what the jurisdiction's approach will be to dealing with those who need protection.
And, you know, understanding, I'm assuming also that your corrections facility, your multiple facilities, within those facilities, certain inmates may be at risk for attack or abuse more than others.
Oh, clearly so. I mean, those requiring protection fall in many, many categories, from the security threat group people who are either being recruited or are at odds with someone in their group, or are at adversarial relationships with other security threat group members, those obviously that are high-profile cases that have received a lot of public attention, those that are convicted of crimes that make them vulnerable, such as child molestation or other sex offenses, those who have informed or testified against others, or are believed to have, whether it actually happened or not, those who are physically or mentally vulnerable, vulnerable either because their physical characteristics limit their movement or make them attractive in terms of sex objects. So there's a whole variety of kinds of people that at least give us pause to think that protection may be appropriate.
Now, is, on all of those folks that you just mentioned, are, you know, as a corrections professional for many years, are there certain inmates that off the bat you know are going to be at more risk than others, or does it sort of depend on the situation around them?
I would argue that it probably is something that should be individualized. We can't say that all child molesters or all rapists or all gang members are those that need protection. I think what should happen is that we have those many categories that could fall into needing protection, and we have to have a process and policies and procedures that allow us to closely examine the individual challenges for that individual before we make a housing placement or an institution or facility placement. So really the categories, I don't think specifically say all of these folks universally need protection. What it does say is that they should be held in a safe place until the individual characteristics are examined, and then that decision on protection be made.
And we're in talking about screening, should this take place? Obviously folks are screened when they come in, you know, for the first time, but are there certain things that people should be looking for right away in that sort of initial screening?
Well, certainly. I think, again, if the individual falls into any one of the categories that I mentioned, it should be a red flag that says now we need to look close, more closely at the history, certainly talking with the inmate themselves in terms of their perception on whether they are at risk in some fashion or not. Frequently we get information from a county jail that may have sent the person into the state system, or prior incarcerations or prior time in a jail or prior experiences in the community. I think it, when we err, we should err by finding more information than possibly we think we initially need.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has to be an ongoing process, because the individual, for example, may display none of the characteristics that would show for a need for protection at the time of reception, but later on, either through challenges with security threat groups or other individuals who are taking advantage of them, may have to be reassessed as the time that they're incarcerated continues.
I have actually a little follow-up question to that. What if somebody has had some experience in corrections and knows what protective custody is, and for some reason doesn't want it? Is that hard to deal with as, you know, corrections person trying to screen properly? And
it is, but I think the obligation that we have is that we have to look at protection first, and there are even instances where I think it's essential that we may place people in protective settings even if they are resisting it themselves. We have the responsibility, we have the capacity to place the person generally about where we want. And I think the need to protect the individual has to come first, and hopefully that individual will be working with the system in that placement.
Now, should how quickly should some sort of protection be put in place once somebody has discussed a need for it?
Well, my perception is that once an individual states that they feel a need for protection, that we must put that individual in a protective setting, whether it's administrative segregation or whatever we call it, a completely protective setting while we investigate the circumstances that the person is relaying to us, and that the information that we can find that may contribute to our figuring out if that's an accurate statement or not. It's almost like the issues with child protective services in this country. If we feel the child could be under harm, we place them in a safe setting until we investigate it. Well, we have to do the same thing in corrections, because the inmate at that point in time is solely reliant on us for almost all of their human needs. And of course, their protection is one of the basic ones.
Sure, that's a good point. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Chase Rivlin, principal of Rivlin Associates and a former corrections commissioner, about protective custody in corrections. I want to continue our discussion about protective custody, and in recent weeks this issue's been in the news after the murder of a Massachusetts inmate who actually was in protective custody when he was murdered. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about checks and balances agencies might need to have to monitor the safety of inmates even after they're in protective custody.
Well, there's a lot of very difficult parts to this whole thing, and part of it is, where do we place these people once we feel, either they feel or we feel, or jointly we feel, that the need for protection exists. In some instances, it can be as simple as a move to a different institution or to an institution where the threat against that person is non-existent. That would be the case, for example, if there's a known predator or threatening person, but not the general population. In many instances, jurisdictions will use either intergovernmental or interstate transfers and transfer the individual somewhere else, either to a county jail if it's from a state system, or to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, or another jurisdiction. And that in and of itself can offer the protection. But in many instances, the individual is at risk from many in the general population. And in those instances, it's, again, depends on the jurisdiction, its size. In small jurisdictions, it's frequently very difficult to have special units, for example. In the larger jurisdictions, frequently special units, or in some cases, entire institutions exist. But I think the overriding principle is that no matter what it is, there has to be a careful examination of who that person is going to be exposed to. Over the years, and over the last 10 or 15 years, we found that the courts have been less receptive to our simply locking people down in administrative segregation kinds of protective custody. And the courts have expected that we provide people in protective custody or protective settings the same kind of general access to programs and privileges that the average person would have, average inmate. And so it puts an additional emphasis and challenge to correctional systems to be able to do that. But there's a variety of creative ways that I think jurisdictions can look at it.
So it's sort of making sure they're safe and yet at the same time providing them with the freedoms that they would otherwise enjoy if they were in the general population, sort of
exactly.
A combination.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if, you know, maybe there are certain charges that an inmate may have come in with or certain crimes that an inmate may have been convicted of that might, you know, make him or her more vulnerable in any setting. My example might be someone who is convicted of child molestation who, you know, may just by virtue of that be at risk no matter where he is versus, you know, a gang member who, if there are no other enemies around him, maybe he wouldn't be so much at risk.
I think, you know, historically we felt, and there's certainly a certain degree of accuracy to it, that people convicted of child molestation or child sex offenses have been more at risk. And I think there's some clearly there's some truth to that. However, I guess I would return to my earlier point that I don't think there's a categorical need to automatically assume that all people convicted of certain crimes automatically need protective custody. I think that it should flag us at the point of reception or even on a continuing basis at the time that we continue to monitor that case. But it should be a highly individualized decision as to what kind of protection that person needs and why they actually need it.
I want to ask you about something that I have kind of come across, in that some states are doing different levels of protective custody depending on, obviously, an inmate's need. And I'm wondering how you think that type of approach works to improve security in these kinds of units.
Well, again, I think given the legal parameters that we're increasingly learning from and the legal requirements, I think it's important that we do what we would like to do with most inmates, and that's put a person person at the lowest custody level that they can safely be held at, safely be held in terms of their behavior, and safely be held in terms of their needs for protection. So if a jurisdiction has the capacity, either through its size or its resources, to have different levels available, I think that's it's legally sound and it's professionally sound to do that. Unfortunately, many of our smaller jurisdictions have a great deal of problem in doing that, simply because of the limitations of size and the limitations of resources. But I think the more the jurisdictions can work toward it, the better served they are.
My final question for you today was about lessons you may have learned as a commissioner related to protective custody that you might share with other practitioners, you know, things that work, maybe worked for you and in your different jurisdictions that you worked in.
Well, sometimes we learn not through what worked, but through what didn't work.
That's right.
I think one of the things I learned early on is that one of the problems we have is that we may have a good process for identifying who needs protective custody, and we may even make a generally appropriate placement. But if all of the staff at all levels aren't attuned to the specific needs of the individual who's in a protective setting, things can go awry. And I can think of two or three instances where individuals who, in one instance, for example, was convicted of a pretty notorious and nationally visible crime, was placed in a protective setting, but was allowed to go to a work setting where presumably he would be working alone. And unfortunately, some of the people in that setting that were supervising it weren't clearly aware of the need to keep completely other inmates away from him, and he was seriously assaulted. Mm-hmm. Because another inmate was allowed in who took advantage of that opportunity. So I think our ability to think about how much information we can get to every individual that's going to be responsible for that person is a terribly important thing, and our policies and procedures should continually be re-examined to make sure that we're doing that in the settings, particularly where people are being held in protective custody.
That's a great point. Well, that concludes today's live talk. Thank you, Chase Rivland of Rivland Associates, for joining us today.
It is a pleasure, Michelle.
Well, we're always happy to have you. And for our audience, to learn more about protective custody and corrections, be sure to read this week's feature story and our profile on corrections.com. For CCNN, I'm Michelle Gasso.
You are listening to the Corrections Connection News Network, CCNN, your weekly news source for the corrections and criminal justice industry.